Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And do we disclosures and disclaimers again the second hour? You want to?
Sure. Yeah, let's do it.
All right. As a disclosure, the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it's also the name of I can say it really fast. SEC registered investment advisor in Salado, Texas, that is not approved or disapproved by the SEC, but regulated by them. And, or it. I guess the SEC is an it, isn't it?
It is an it.
Yeah, and the stuff we say on here is not investment advice. It is educational, and that's all it is, because investment advice is only given to people under the circumstances that they're in and so on, and specific to them. And so don't buy or sell on what we're saying here. Please,
yeah.
please.
Do your research. We're trying to help with education. If you need specific advice, you can call us off the air. What people have asked me about that recently, why don't we give advice on the air? And there's a really, really good reason for it.
Well, we can give some advice.
Buy low, sell high.
Buy low, sell high. Don't get involved in a land war on the Asian continent.
Right. And avoid iocane powder. Yeah.
That's probably a good idea.
So that's an important piece. But the reason why we don't give advice on the air is because it isn't one size fits all. I wish it was. There's a lot of what we say is educational, and that is one size fits all. It's good building block material to make good decisions later. But advice is actionable stuff that's tailored to who you are. And when we give advice through the Personal Wealth Coach as fiduciaries, as investment advisors, it needs to be custom tailored to the person. It just is a quick statement. People say, you know, all the time on the radio, people say buy this fund or that fund. It may be totally the wrong fund for 90% of our listeners. It might be only a good fund for 10% of our listeners. And so we don't give advice on the air. When we give advice, it's going to be tailored. I guess that is the simplest way of saying it. I think it's malpractice to give blanket advice to everyone. If someone is saying everyone should own fill in the blank, whether that's a Chevy vehicle or a type of investment, they're selling something.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. 254-773-1400 is the number to call in here. And caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach.
My question sounds insignificant after what you've been discussing around the world, but I have a question about Texas.
All right. Texas or taxes?
T-E-X-A-S.
All right.
How I see three crises. School finance has been kicked down the road forever. Sooner or later, I hope the state addresses school finance.
Uh-huh.
Number two, nursing homes. Mitt Laughlin had on his program about the bankruptcy of the largest nursing home chain in Texas and how they're getting out. And since I worked in nursing homes, I know that reimbursement rates are so low for nursing homes.
Low and slow.
Yes, sir. And it's probably going to get worse. And number three, health care, which is, a national U.S. problem. Little River going bankrupt. So how are these just state problems going to affect my taxes and the state? Do you have any suggestions or comments?
Sure. Yeah.
And I'll hang up. May I hang up?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you for the call.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. All of those issues, while they can be handled at the state level, are national issues as well. Nursing homes across the country are in trouble. Healthcare system across the country, nobody can say that they're in good shape. There's a lot of profitability in pharmaceutical companies, but anybody that's looked at their insurance rates, inflation in insurance, health insurance rates has been double digits for almost a decade. That cannot continue. It's just not possible for that to continue and be borne by people. It would become too much of a burden. When it comes down to that other piece that she talked about, and that's the education finance, school finance. Texas is in a lot better shape than the rest of the country on that. If you look at where we stand on finance for school, it's in a lot better shape. But there's still some major problems. I feel like Texas has been leading on the finance side of schooling, but not doing so well on the curriculum side. And when it comes to healthcare and to nursing homes, there, I do expect long-term there to be some issues. Medicare pays for a big chunk of the nursing home environment. And Texas did not expand its Medicare program with the Affordable Care Act, with Obamacare. So there is a small group of people, it's not too small, that is above poverty line but below making enough money to make it line in old age that simply cannot pay for their nursing home care, and the nursing homes aren't allowed to have them leave the nursing home. It would cause them to expire. It would cause them to die to get them to leave the nursing home. That's it. That's a major issue. And those are issues that are not fun to talk about at the political level.
We've got a very fundamental problem with health care in the United States. And without getting in any way political, I just simply want to say something that's very clear. Across Europe, the mainstream economies in Europe, Germany, Britain, Ireland, the Norwegian, the Scandinavian countries, you go down through these countries and you look at the quality of care based on what people on surveys are saying, and they're saying they're generally quite happy with their health care.
Mm-hmm.
The mortality rate for just about everything, including longevity, is better in Europe than it is in the United States. The number of people
Is there a mortality rate for longevity? Is that now a cause of death?
Well, mortality rate...
Well, how did he die? He lived too
mortality
long.
Mortality rates and longevity are actually a little different thing.
Yeah.
And basically, people are living longer there. They have lower mortality from various diseases. You start down the list of all the things that healthcare is supposed to take care of. It looks like they're doing a much better job there. And they're spending about a third less than we do per citizen per year. Now, what's the difference? If you look at the pharmaceutical industry in the United States and you look at the for-profit healthcare industry in the United States, they are phenomenally profitable. They are among the highest earning corporations in the United States. So we've made a decision collectively as Americans that we want corporations that supply pharmaceuticals and that supply healthcare for profit to do very, very well and have very high profits, but we want to spend an inordinate amount of money and have sections of the healthcare system go broke.
Right. And that's really where we are.
And there is a solution to it. And
there's
it
multiples.
It is, well, there's one solution that's pretty obvious.
Let me give the two things that work right now, as is in the United States, two systems that are working well when you look at satisfaction and you look at mortality rates, when you look at quality of care, all the things that you're looking at. There's one extreme, which is very similar to many of the European areas, the VA system. VA system looks great. I mean, there's people talk about it needs to be fixed. It does. There are still problems with it. But when you compare long-term quality of care issues there, they look a lot more like Southwest Airlines as opposed to American Airlines. Most hospitals fall way below the mark when it comes to satisfaction, when it comes to knowledge about what you're paying for and so on. So the VA, which is in effect free, it's been earned, so this, I mean, paid for with blood and with bad joints and damage to the body, but it's in effect a free service. And then you have the opposite extreme of that, which is doctors that have just decided not to take insurance, that they are in private practice and you pay a monthly subscription and they're building their practices larger and larger. It looks a lot more like a 1950s or 60s era private practice than what you would consider a private practice today, which is run by basically the insurance companies. And both of those models do really well for satisfaction and long-term care of patients. the whole middle ground is falling apart.
I think there needs to be a caveat on that second solution. And the second solution is that those physicians that are taking monthly payments to do all the medical treatment for somebody.
It doesn't cover hospital care.
It doesn't cover hospital care, and it also doesn't cover sick, poor people because they basically don't take them.
Yeah.
So basically, if you're well off and you're relatively healthy, you can remain well off and relatively healthy
right.
as long as you don't go to the hospital.
Yeah, and we still have an issue it's going away this year, but you get a fine from the federal government for not having insurance if you use that route. So there are big broken issues, big ones, that need to be addressed. And with the advent of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, the Democrats said everything's fixed. And the Republicans have said there's nothing fixed. There's no compromise there. We need to move the conversation away from a very politicized law to, all right, Republicans and Democrats both have had on their platform for the last multiple decades improving the healthcare system. Right now, Republicans still have the chant in the background about abolishing Obamacare, but they don't have anything to replace it. The Democrats are still fully entrenched on nothing's wrong, everything's right, because we have Obamacare.
Well, I wouldn't even say that. I would say that the Democrats are leaning over towards Medicare, some form of Medicare for All.
Medicare for All is the new thing that they're saying, and there's we were talking about this in the car on the way to the studio. There's at least 12 versions of that out there, from the extreme socialist, just basically keep Medicare exactly like it is, only give it to everyone, which there's no way that will work. The expenses are just too high with Medicare. To the other extreme of it's basically like a far more capitalist version of Obamacare.
No, the bottom line to it is we have decided as a nation that medical care is a right.
Yeah.
If you're sick, you're in a car accident, whatever, and you show up at an emergency room and the hospital takes government funding at any point.
They can't turn you away. If you've got blood spurting, they've got to see you.
And what's more, once you're admitted to the hospital, let's just say that you've had untreated diabetes, and you've got gangrene in one leg or both legs, and they have to amputate your feet, and you need to go into the ICU, which is extremely expensive, and you have to have surgery. Once you show up in the emergency room with a situation like that, they have to keep you, and they have to keep taking care of you at tremendous expense.
With whether or not you have the ability to pay being out the window.
So we've decided, as a nation, that's the law. We are not going to turn people away because they don't have money or insurance and just let them die.
And I don't hear even the most conservative Republicans that are kind of on the political stage saying, no, turn away people that are dying at the emergency room. You don't hear that said. There's some libertarians that say, fend for yourself. I think that's a little extreme. I tend to lean libertarian, but I'm not quite to the point where you just leave people to die that have shown up with wounds.
We have laws that say the medical system must care for anybody who shows up in an emergency room and if need be, put them in the hospital. But we have no methodology in place of paying for it.
Right.
That leads to basically it is the government requiring services from corporations, but providing no payment for it.
Right.
And we don't have a system for providing payment for it. And
the closest we've gotten is the Affordable Care Act, and that was a mess as well.
Fundamentally, if we're going to say everybody gets health care, which we do, but we wait until an emergency, which is really absurd. We also have to say then everybody pays for it or it won't work.
Right.
It's that simple. It is a matter of saying, in other words, a universal governmental if the government is universally going to say corporations
they put the mandate down, right.
You will care for these people, then the government must also say, here's how we pay for it, and that amounts to a single-payer system for everybody, whether we like it or not.
Right, and that concept, we can change that concept. We can say, all right, it's not necessary for all federally funded hospitals to see everybody that comes in the door.
So people then can be turned away from emergency rooms,
right,
and just
die. It's a possible thing. We could change that. But I don't think that's palatable. I don't think that there are a lot of people, especially around Christmas time, that are going to say, let's vote for that. It's there.
But they're also going to say, let's not vote for paying for it.
Right, exactly. So where we are right now is the medical system is paid for with large amounts of federal dollars. The federal government has put a lot of unfunded mandates on healthcare, as well as requirements on insurance. But we still claim that it's a capitalistic healthcare system. It isn't. It is some kind of Frankensteinian socialist capitalist mix where you don't have the best of either side. And people say the best of socialism. Yeah, the best of socialism is a family. A family unit is socialism. It's truly communism. My daughter is 3 years old, although she will tell you she's 3 3/4. She does not read very well. She doesn't have a job. I'm paying for her clothes. I'm likely to pay for her schooling from now until the next century. but this concept is pure communism. As long as everybody involved is a volunteer, it works. As soon as you start mandating communism, then human nature kicks in and says, I don't want to pay for some stranger's kid to go to school, though we do. That's what our public school system is. That's socialism. We have to look at what degree of socialism is the degree that we want when it comes to healthcare, when it comes to school and school finance. We got to say, at what level do we pay through? You know, the last presidential election, the Democrats were talking about college for everyone and no student loans, and somebody's got to pay for all of this, and that's really what it comes down to. That's not me saying, no, don't do it. It's me saying, let's find a way that's palatable to pay for it. We did it with the school system. I don't hear even – I mean, the school voucher program is the closest that the conservative end of the spectrum has gone to say it's not a human right to have schooling. In fact, if you don't go to school, it's against the law. So that's where we are. That's socialism, and we've just got to say, where do we want capitalism to stick in?
The same thing is true with nursing homes.
Yes.
Each year, and this is something that's done in Texas, not just federally, but also in the state of Texas, every year there's a new bill or set of bills raising the requirements for nursing home and giving them, because some scandal came up and the people were not properly taken care of, so they raise the standards, and that's another unfunded mandate each year. The state, through Medicaid, the federal government gives the state a certain amount of money for Medicaid, and the state then doles out the money for Medicaid to people. The state then funds the people who can't afford to go into nursing homes, but they don't raise the rates. They don't raise the amount of money they're paying every time they raise the standard that a nursing home has to have. And so once again, you reach the point where to meet minimum standards and avoid fines, a nursing home has to spend more to take care of an elderly person than the government will pay them when they don't have the money to pay for it themselves.
Right.
And there's some cheating going on here.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a lack of enforcement. For example, very, very common from people going to nursing homes in the years prior to that, for the heirs to transfer wealth from those people to their heirs.
Yeah.
And get it away from there so that when they go into the nursing home, they'll be eligible for Medicaid. Now, that's technically illegal.
There's whole industries built around it.
But no one wants to enforce it. No one wants to enforce. So the laws on the books that said it's illegal to transfer money away from somebody who you know is going to go into a nursing home for the purposes of avoiding going into the nursing home.
Right.
But no prosecutor that wants to keep his job is going to go and prosecute people for that.
And that's a cultural issue that we have to recognize in the law. If we individually, And I see, man, we have high net worth clients that come in and they have this question. What can we do to transfer assets out of mom or grandma's accounts to get them set up to gifted to her heirs so that when she goes to the nursing home, she's not going to have to pay for it? And that's literally, and they don't say that. And they don't say she's not going to have to pay for it so that she can get the aid that she needs is what they say. Well, that's the thing, is the aid that she needs, does she need it if she's just given away all these assets?
The point here is, if we decide, we have decided collectively that when people get old and they can't take care of themselves, that it's okay for that they should go into nursing homes. But we have once again said, but we don't want to pay for it.
Right.
And so Medicaid, and I think the solution, the caller asked a very good question.
Mm-hmm.
When is this going to be fixed?
I see no fix in sight.
Well, I do.
I don't see it yet.
I can tell you when it's going to be fixed. When the Medicaid trust fund
when
it runs out of money, which is in about 5 years.
Right. That we got to fix it at the crisis. I would prefer to fix it before that, but you're right. The crisis will be when we say, oh, we got to fix it.
The trend lines on these funds, the Medicare trust fund, the Social Security trust fund, and believe me, there's some other crises you didn't cite. For instance, military retirements.
Sure, but we were talking about the state level.
But
so when we go to the national level, we can start bringing in cost of college, cost of military retirements, of federal retirements, entitlements of all types.
But these situations are all federal. You may think they're not, but a big chunk of what the state gets to spend on education, we're talking about education reform.
Yeah, that's federal.
Comes from federal money. A big chunk of what the biggest chunk of what is spent on healthcare isn't state, it's federal.
Yeah.
And the trend lines are all coming together in the early 2030s, which is like 11 years from now,
it's
folks.
Not very far.
In the early 2030s, all of the systems that we are currently using to fund unsustainable retirement and medical benefits all go bust within about a 2 or 3 year period in the early 2030s.
Yeah, this will help people understand how far 11 years is. It's not very far. If you go back in time, it's the beginning of the recession. People remember that really strongly still.
Right.
That's basically 11 years ago. 2007 was when we really started getting into the nitty-gritty of things aren't going well.
And for whatever it's worth, we probably will be having a knock them down, drag them through the mud, kick them in the face recession at that point. So the answer to when this stuff is going to get fixed
tends to get fixed in the crisis.
When we have a major crisis. And the last major crisis when I say major, I mean really, really major, not just that's pretty bad. Actually, the Great Recession should be called the Pretty Bad Recession instead of the Great Recession.
I didn't find it great at all.
Well, the point is that the last time we had this was in the 1930s.
Yeah.
And we reformed just about everything.
When you think of the school system as it is, it was formed in that time period.
We, by the way, in the 1930s, the beginning of the 1930s, threw out the Republicans wholesale and instituted the Democrats, who turned the entire economy and gave us what at the time was considered socialism that would destroy the country, this thing called Social Security. And I hate to, without being political, I'm going to say we are doing an amazingly good job of not remembering
history,
the past.
Yeah.
And so we're probably going to repeat it. I would suspect the crisis will come in about 11 years. And in about 11 or 12 years, the solution will be to throw out the current political leadership, install a new political leadership, because we'll be having either a depression or a severe recession, and all this stuff will get fixed.
Yeah, or the last time around, it took a long time to fix.
Well, we're a little quicker each time.
Hopefully this time around, we'll be quicker. And that, that Texas has been forward-looking. The fact that we have a balanced budget every time we have a legislative session, that's a mandatory thing. There's a lot of problems with their system, but that is a big benefit. The fact that we keep filling up our rainy day fund when it's not raining and using the rainy day fund when it is, again, really good idea, long-term proper strategy, if we could apply that same concept to getting ahead of the crisis in Medicaid, getting ahead of the crisis in school finance, getting ahead of this stuff and solving it before it's a really expensive problem. And it's still possible. It's still possible now to solve at the federal level and the state level a lot of these problems and save a lot of money instead of waiting 5 to 11 years to solve it.
It's possible, but I don't think politically.
And no, I don't think it's palatable.
The reason that it's not politically possible, or as you say, palatable, which I agree with that term, is that we just cut corporate taxes a lot.
Yeah.
And that was probably a necessity, although it did not have the effect. The studies that are coming out now indicate, and the market certainly shows it, the market is down from when we cut corporate taxes.
Right.
But we also cut personal taxes at that point and are running an unsustainable deficit. And we started cutting funding at the federal level for a lot of these things that we just started talking about.
Yeah.
The reality is, and this is not a very pretty picture, and people don't like paying more taxes, but we expect our government to provide benefits and services to us well in excess of what we pay in taxes.
Yeah. And that's the reality. And otherwise, we wouldn't have excessive debt every year. We're making more debt every year because we're spending more than we're making. That's the simple statement.
We basically need to raise, it's not a pretty picture, we need to raise taxes about $1.5 trillion a year.
Or cut into some spending that nobody wants to cut. You want to cut your Medicare or your Social Security or your defense, those are all three things that most people look at and say, we need that stuff. If you still want to do roads, if you still want to do the FBI, if you still want to do all the other federal stuff, we either have to raise taxes or really cut into the three things that we don't want to cut. So this is where we are right now. It's not a pretty picture, but it's the picture that we painted ourselves. So let's deal with it.
And by the way, you're certainly welcome to call on this if you disagree with this, but I can tell you, but don't call in and say, let's cut welfare and let's cut
it's too small a portion.
Foreign aid, because basically that's saying our family's on the way to bankruptcy, so we're going to stop buying chewing gum.
Yeah.
Because the amount that a family spends on chewing gum is the equivalent percentage of what we spend on foreign aid and welfare in the United States.
Yeah. It's just not a big thing. Now, one thing that's happened is that welfare has become tax credits, so it's really hard from the conservative side to say, let's cut tax credits. But that's how we're paying welfare these days, is that you get that low-income people get a lot of money back that they didn't necessarily pay in.
But they have to be working to get the money.
Yeah.
Well,
they don't necessarily. There are some non-refunded credits that you can get.
In order to get earned income tax credits, which is the big one.
Right. That's
you have
the
to have earned income.
You have
basically
to have earned income. Yeah.
We've decided as a nation to not impose income taxes
on the lowest income.
But at the same time, we do impose a 15% tax on them for FICA.
Social Security and Medicare.
And so on. So we're basically taxing
everybody,
the lowest income earners at 15%. And then it rises up to the middle class are paying around 30%.
This what you're saying right now, from my perspective, if we don't solve this issue first, there's a lot of other issues that are going to have trouble. And that is, we've just done a big tax cut. If we don't reform the tax system so that it is understandable, so that people know that they're doing it appropriately, so that, you know, the fact that you just said the lowest income people have a 15% tax. Well, when you really look down into it, it's a 7.6% tax on their employed salary or hourly wages, and one on the other end from their employer doing exactly the same thing. That's a tax on the consumer, but we're splitting it up in a way that nobody can really see what's happening there.
Unless they're self-employed, in which case they pay both sides.
Right, and then that's self-employment tax.
But in most cases, they ignore the taxes and avoid tax and do tax evasion.
Right, and then we come forward and we say, all right, but the bottom 50% of people don't pay taxes. And I hear that in the headlines. I see it around.
True.
It's not true. It's true for pure income taxes, though the payroll taxes for Medicare and Social Security, the FICA stuff, I would call that an income tax too, because it's a tax on your income.
It's a tax on the income. It goes into the general pot of money.
Make up a governmental vocabulary that's different than the real world, and we say that your tax bracket is capped out at 37% when it's really got FICA on top of that. And that's, you know, the whole concept of what do you pay in tax? People don't know what they pay in taxes. And that's not a good way. That's the same problem that we have when it comes to medical care or student care. If you don't know what you're paying for, who's the customer? How do you keep the people who receive the money accountable? Whether that's the government, the school, the insurance company, the medical care, it doesn't matter. If you're buying something at a restaurant, you know what you're paying. You hold them accountable. You don't go back there if the food's bad. That's not true when you go to an emergency room. You don't know what you're paying, and you got to go there even if the food's bad.
And take this into account. This is something that we object to. Yes, schools are probably underfunded compared with the education level that we need to have to keep going and be on, because we're falling behind the other nations.
But the system itself is broken.
Yes. Medical care, we basically have nursing homes going out of business, as Ed was saying in the last hour.
Right.
We've got some underfunding here, but at the same time, in October, we don't have November's numbers yet. In October, the United States government ran a $100 billion deficit.
Yeah.
If you multiply that times 12, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that that's $1.2 trillion. Even the Office of Management and Budget, which is in the White House, is acknowledging that for this fiscal year, the federal government will run a deficit in excess of $1 trillion in the middle of a boom. That is the other big issue that is going to come home to roost, is that we simply can't afford to borrow an extra $1 trillion a year.
In good years.
In good years, and then as soon as we get a recession, and we expect a recession.
Recessions happen.
In a couple of years, 2020 is when we're looking at probably a recession. See that typically go up by 50%. We can't afford to do that, and yet we just did a tax cut. And that therein, we collectively, the people of the United States, elected the representatives.
Yeah,
and by the way, largely reelected those representatives.
And I have benefited from those tax cuts. I've enjoyed them. I'm going to do my best to maintain those savings for the future.
And that is going to create a crisis.
I'm not going to voluntarily send the government more money than I have to.
But at the
same time, we need to be giving the government more money than we are, otherwise we're in trouble long term.
We've been talking about the fact that an inversion in the yield curve is a pretty good indication we're about to have a recession within 12 to 18, maybe 24 months. We're looking at a minor inversion right now, but the minor inversion, I saw a good study on that.
It's
in
just
Barron's.
Between three, five, and 7 years.
But the Barron's article indicated every time in the past we've had one of those, the market has risen 20% in the following year. So
unless we go further inverted, and then we have another issue.
But the reason we're headed towards an inversion in the yield curve, which would tend to produce a recession, is the government is borrowing money. Short term, the big deficits that we're seeing right now are not being done long term while interest rates are relatively low. They're being done at 2 to 3 years. And so that means in 2 to 3 years, all that debt rolls over again.
Yeah.
And as a result, the yield curve is getting pushed up in the short term. The short term rates are going up because the government is borrowing money. Long term rates are going down because they expect the long term economy not to be so hot. And so the very thing that the administration wishes to not happen, which is a recession in 2020, is being generated by the tax cuts and the choice to borrow money short term rather than long term.
Right. Yeah. And that's an issue. It's a big issue. It's one that it's not as huge an issue as entitlement reform. It's the long term stuff. I would really, 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 I should say really a lot more times on the federal level, like to see some complete renovation of the tax code, simplification, make it easy to understand, make it easy to pay. It is not either of those now. Combine all the different forms of federal taxation under one group of things. It's being spent that way anyway.
You are a pipe dreamer.
I am a pipe dreamer. There's no way this is ever going to happen, but it sure would be nice. It sure would be nice if we did this in a logical way, but that's not politics.
If everybody could see the total tax bill they pay one document.
We'd have a tea party.
But we do need to play some commercials so that Town Square Media and KTM can stay in business. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. And hopefully we'll be back on the other side of these commercials.
We'll see. You keep talking while I try to figure this out.
Keep talking while you...
play button is not readily apparent, Tom.
So we don't know how to play commercials. Right. Well, they don't need the money. What they should have is just mandates and no money at KTM. See?
Maybe it's this one. I'm going to give it a shot, but it might be from last hour. So we'll see.
All right.
You ready?
Let's try it.
Here we go.
All right. We're coming back. Without the commercials, because we couldn't figure out how to get the commercials to play.
Yeah, it played, but it played as our bagpipes, which I don't have a problem with that. I like bagpipes.
Bagpipes sound like they're still playing a little bit.
Yeah, they are. And I'm going to hit stop here, and hopefully that's not the thing that's destroying everything here. So
The Scots are actually pretty good at that. You know,
yeah,
anyway,
destroying
well,
things?
Let's get back to the economy. We've talked about the fact that we expect the current and lagging indicators in the economy to keep going like gangbusters for a bit longer, probably 6 months, maybe a year. However, there are some indicators out there that we need to be aware of, which indicates, again, that about a year from now, we're going to be looking down the gun barrel of a potential recession. Factory orders, United States factory orders, dropped by 2.1%. And there's a lag to this stuff. This is in October. We're just now getting the data. So we got factory orders dropping by 2.1%. But very importantly, within that set of numbers that we call factory orders, durables dropped by 4.3%. This is just for 1 month. And that's a big number. Now, 2 months ago, we had everything growing along very nicely. It went pretty much flat in September. October came around, and we're seeing a very significant drop. For instance, in September, the durable goods orders were zero. In August, they were up 4.7%. So now they're down 4.3%. This is a trend, and I think it's a very important trend. Now, will this produce an immediate drop someplace? No, because the orders come in, and then they go into process. And sometimes there's a backlog, and sometimes the industry keeps up and is manufacturing along very nicely. And right now, they're in the position where the new orders that they expect to start to work on several months from now are dropping. The current manufacturing is going along very nicely, and the stuff they're shipping out the door looks really, really good. So if you were just count what's going out the door right now, American manufacturing just looks hunky-dory. And if you look at go onto the factory floor and you see that they're pretty much working at pretty close to full capacity, that looks really, really good. But if you go up into the place where they receive orders, you will see that there's roughly 5% fewer new orders coming in this month than there was last month.
Right. And in the middle of this, we had the unemployment and hiring numbers that just came out. We hired 155,000 new people. So new jobs created 155,000, which is good news. But that's a major slowdown from what we've been seeing. Why is that important? That first number is only mildly seasonally adjusted. It's only lightly salted. The season's added, there's a little nutmeg because we've got Christmas going on. But that number is usually a lot bigger going into December because a lot of part-time people are hired during this month to do the retail stuff. So the fact that we have a smaller number there and looking around the country, hiring is slowing. labor shortage has been a boon to workers. They're getting paid more. But companies are having trouble expanding because they can't find people to hire.
Now, wages are up about 3.1% from last year. But productivity is only about 1.3% up from last year. What that boils down to is people have more money to spend for doing the same thing.
That's the definition of inflation, folks.
Which causes them to go out there and buy a lot more stuff, which is why consumer spending is up and looks very, very healthy.
Yeah.
But it also is a big reason that we just hit a trade deficit number that's the largest in American history, $55.7 billion in October.
In 1 month.
And why would it cause the trade deficit to go up, even though there were tariffs already in place? And the answer is twofold. The answer is because Americans have a lot more money to spend, largely because of the tax cut in this case, than we have the ability to – we don't have enough people to manufacture the stuff
right.
that we need to supply what consumers now have the money to buy, and we're borrowing the difference. But let me throw one other thing
okay.
in. The other thing is the law of unintended consequences. We've talked about the steel tariffs, and that's the major ones that are in place, and also some tariffs on Chinese goods that are largely offset by currency fluctuations. But the bottom line to it is a lot of things, particularly durable goods, made in the United States have now become significantly more expensive because of the tariffs, while imported goods from places other than China have decreased in price because the dollar has risen. So the end result is the tariffs have directly contributed to a larger trade deficit for the United States.
Yeah, and this is the simple way of looking at it. We don't make enough stuff here for the amount of stuff we want to buy. We can't. If we look at steel, before the tariffs hit, before, you know, move back pre-political influence, we produced 73% of the steel used in the United States in the United States. That's a significant number. That's a really large number. But we still are buying 27% of our steel. You put tariffs on it, and the idea here is that we'll start producing more steel in the United States. That's the concept. That's the hope. Okay, we'll hire more people, produce more steel, maybe we'll get closer to 100%. We're now producing about 71% of the steel that we're using in the United States. Why? Well, because we've had some problems at the plants. We went up into a 75-76% range, and we've had to take some plants offline because we've broken things and we didn't have proper training and we were doing way, way, way too much overtime. The United Steelworkers threatening strikes. They didn't quite ever get to the strike itself, but they wanted to work less hours, still get paid more. That's ongoing negotiation. So what we've got is we're still not making 100% of the steel in the United States. If we want to continue to build things with steel, we've got to buy it at a more expensive level elsewhere. The prices on local steel have gone up, and we've mentioned this in the past. We've got a 50% increase in the price of steel with a 25% tariff. So steel in the United States...
It's 10% tariff.
25% on steel.
Really?
It's 10% on aluminum.
Okay, so it's 25% on steel, so that's what's causing. Well, we do have a caller coming in on 254-773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was on there earlier talking to you. Now that y'all's talking about steel and everything, my curiosity is, you know, Africa's known for their diamonds and their flourishing with that. What is the United States known for as far as having something of value that the economy and the whole world would like to have? You know, I was always curious on that. Thank you for talking about that because I was curious. Thank you, sir, and you have a good day.
Thanks.
Well, all right. We have oil.
Oil?
We're the largest oil producer in the world.
We have just claimed that title back. We're technically energy independent, though that we still import and export a lot, so it's not really energy independent. We have uranium. A lot of the uranium of the world comes from here, though there's a lot from Africa. We used to have rare earth as being majority here. We used to have steel as being majority here. We still have the ability to go back to that, but it's available cheaper elsewhere, so we don't. Helium, which people go, why is that a big deal? Well, there's for superconductors and for a lot of other things, the major industrial capacity usage for helium comes from Texas, actually, and there's a new discovery in Africa, but they're not quite ready to start using it. But we've got dollars and intellectual property.
There it is. You hit the last two. You want to know what the United States is noted for in its primary export is dollars. We manufacture a product. Dollars are not just money. They are the equivalent of gold. And it's like we have the ability in the United States to manufacture as much gold as we can put value on. We choose to limit the manufacture. That's what the Federal Reserve does.
Which maintains the value.
So that the dollar is worth a dollar minus 2% a year. That's their gold, their goal. And their goal is that the dollar will depreciate at 2% a year. That's in essence, we manufacture a product called the dollar. We charge the world 2% a year to own our dollars. And it is phenomenally profitable for the United States, and it pretty much zeros out the trade deficit. Matter of fact, I think we have a trade surplus because of that, and I can make a powerful argument on that issue. The other thing, and Jake mentioned this, is intellectual property, just property rights in general. The United States has property rights. You invent something in the United States and you patent, and the full force of the federal government and the legal system is behind you in protecting that patent. That is simply not true in the rest of the world. We have property rights in the sense that we just assume that the government can't come in and arbitrarily, unless you're, in, of course, in Michigan, take away your property. In the state of Michigan, by the way, a guy just lost his house that he paid $60,000 for. Not much of a house because he's a poor man and he's ill. But he had a $60,000 house, and he owed $4.84 to his county that he had overlooked. And so the county repossessed his entire house, sold it, by the way, for $24,000, which is absurd, and kept the difference. And the courts in Michigan just ruled that was perfectly legal because it's on the books. It's being appealed to the Supreme Court, and it'll be interesting how that turns out. It's very irritating to me to think that that can even exist someplace, but it does.
There's also seizure based on any crime. So this is one that's Indiana, I think, is the one where the Land Rover was seized based on Land Rover that was purchased with inherited money, but the person was a drug dealer, an admitted drug dealer, pled guilty. But the money for the Land Rover came from an inheritance, and the cash money that was the drug money got seized, but they also seized the Land Rover and are selling it at auction, and that's going to the Supreme Court to say, are you allowed to do that? And one of the questions at the Supreme Court level was, well, technically, speeding is breaking the law. Can you seize
a
Lamborghini from someone who's speeding 5 miles over the speed limit? And the person that was arguing at the state for the state said, well, technically, yes, that's what it says on the book. And there was a lot of laughter in the courtroom, but it's one of those things.
But you see, that argument isn't presented in other countries, because in other countries, and that's probably the single largest difference between the economy in Mexico and the economy in the United States, is the fact that in Mexico, fee simple ownership of property doesn't exist. The state owns everything.
And they can take your stuff
whenever
they want.
And they can take it anytime they want to.
They don't have to pay you for it.
This is actually true in most of the rest of the world. And you want to know something that we have that is incredibly valuable? That's one of the reasons people come to the United States, because they are secure, unless they live in Indiana or Michigan, in the ownership of their property.
Now, Kansas, too. Kansas, they seize cash in a car for speeding.
There's limited ability to do this, but once the Supreme Court, if the Supreme Court of the United States rules you can't do that, and it applies to the states, well, that's the end of that.
Right. States aren't allowed to do it anymore.
And I kind of think the Supreme Court is going to rule that the federal prohibition against excessive fines and the federal prohibition against unreasonable taking, illegal taking without due process,
search and seizure,
will be held to apply to the states, and so much
because the search side has been held by the Supreme Court,
right.
that the state can't just walk into your house and search whenever they want. They've got to have a warrant. That's the search side of search and seizure.
And they have to have reasonable cause.
Right. So next they're going to say, hey, you can't just take people's stuff because you want to fund your budget. And that's...
Well, Nolanville will go out of business.
Well, that's an old thing. I don't know if Nolanville is still a speed trap.
Still doing it.
But that, you know, 30 years ago, they were well known for it.
But anyway, so the things that we have are largely intellectual. And the two things that we have that we export that are probably the most valuable, we don't really export one of them, which is the property rights. The other one, the principal thing we export in the United States, although we're getting to oil, being we are the biggest oil producer, and I think we're not to the biggest oil export yet. But once the new pipelines go in next year, we could become the biggest oil exporter in
right.
the world. And there's lots more of that where it came from. The price have to go up a little bit, but
I think
probably will.
The principal thing we export is our service. As a service, maybe as software as a service.
I would say
and
the dollar.
Because Microsoft... The operating system that Google uses, the operating system that Apple uses, so iOS and Android, most of the server platforms. If you think about the value in the intellectual property, the fact that the operating systems of the computers of a Mercedes-Benz that's manufactured in Germany are based on American operating systems. They write their own stuff, but the core of the software is an American export.
And the reason Nobel Prize winning authors have come to this conclusion, by the way, not just me, the reason that the intellectual property is created in the United States is because of our property rights.
Yeah, we get to keep what we create.
Can I change the subject here?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. We've only got a couple of minutes, so.
Yeah, but I wanted to
1 minute,
this in for
less than a minute. Go ahead.
Bitcoin dropped to $3,500 per coin.
Oh, wow.
And remember, it was at 20,000 at one point.
Yeah.
That means it has fallen a lot.
Yeah, you can do the math on that. The fall is huge.
Like 90-some percent fall from its height, and we've predicted that, and we can pat ourselves on the back. The bottom line to it is if something doesn't have any value or utility and people are paying a lot for it, it's like emu eggs. It is going to fall, and when it falls, it's going to break.
Yes, it's a nasty break. And we're about out of time. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting on the weekends at
254-947-1111.
Or 1-800-914-7526. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and read our newsletters, listen to podcasts. You can send us email at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And until next week, I'd like to, first off, thank you very much for listening. And second, please listen again. Check out our website. It's worth it. And we'll see you next week or talk to you next week.
This has been the Personal Wealth Coach.